Yeah, a word about those of you who are interested in the AMP conference. I wouldn't wait. It looks like it is going to sell out. So if you want to get involved in that, I would probably this week you need to do something about it. Okay. I was talking to a meteorologist. We actually had a meteorologist attend this class for a while. The guy who's on ABC, Dallas Rains. Yeah. Anyways, a friend of his was telling me that what it would take to end the drought here in Southern California would be 300 days of rain like we're experiencing today. That would take care of it. So we've had a few of those days, but not enough. So, and I was sharing with him, oh, that's kind of what it's like we're in my hometown of Vancouver, British Columbia. I mean, 300 days of rain is no problem. We get that all the time. So, in fact, I remember I wasn't a Christian when I grew up in Vancouver, but I do started reading Genesis when I was 17. And when I read about the flood of 40 days and 40 nights and said, what's the big deal? I mean, I had experienced two winters where the rain did not stop for over 70 days. Now, it wasn't torrential. Sometimes it was torrential, sometimes it was moderate, sometimes it was light, but it never actually got to the point of mist. It just kept raining all the time. And my mother, I remember, she got depressed because Vancouver's quite a bit more north of us, and in the wintertime when it's raining like that, it's almost like night. It gets really dark, even at noontime. So, yeah. And we had a fellow in our high school, and he was from Saudi Arabia. And I remember my classmates were kidding him about the fact that his relatives had worshipped the sun. And he said, well, you would too if you ever saw it. So, so yeah, there are places that get a lot more rain. Matter of fact, I remember taking Kathy to Strathcona Park on Vancouver Island. And she heard, I told her, look, there's over 1,000 waterfalls in the park. It's really spectacular. It is. It's an incredible place. But she said, can we please go the driest time of the year? And I said, well, that would be the first week of August. That's where they get the least amount of rain. So we went there the first week of August. It didn't rain heavy, but it never stopped raining the entire time we were there. And we had dinner at the Strathcona Park Lodge. And the waitresses were complaining about the drought they were having. And so Kathy said, well, what do you mean drought? It's been raining nonstop. And she says, well, you need to understand, we're only getting 1 meter of rain a month. So that's the definition of a drought in north central Vancouver Island. Anything less than 40 inches of rain a month. So just to give you some perspective on the rain we're having here, hey, just a little light sprinkle we're getting here. Well, I've been gone for 3 weeks. Last week I was in Pittsburgh doing some TV shows. Well, that was interesting. I was on the plane going to Pittsburgh. Half the passengers were wearing Steelers jerseys. And then I was driving through the suburbs of Pittsburgh, and still half the people had Steelers jerseys on. So I guess they like their football team. So, and somebody's making a lot of money selling those jerseys. Hey, I left you with an assignment. Anybody remember what the assignment was that I left 4 weeks ago? In fact, we're a week overdue, right? I said the third Sunday of January, I want to report on the assignment that I gave to several of you. This is the fourth, so you actually had an extra week to pull it off.
The definition of a fool.
Okay. And you remember the context, why we're doing this. Okay, for those of you who are new, a couple of you are new, we're going through the entire Bible and examining in some depth all the creation texts in the Bible. And right now we're in the book of Ecclesiastes. And Ecclesiastes deals with several subjects, but the doctrine of creation is weaved through it. And it's something we've been stressing this class. When you're looking at the creation texts, see how the doctrine of creation is linked with other doctrines. You know, we talked about how every creation text links the doctrine of creation with the doctrine of redemption. So look for that link. But what we've been noticing here as we've been going through the book of Ecclesiastes is that the author, which I believe is King Solomon, has a passion for reaching people that are shutting God out of their lives. In fact, you can see a lot of existential philosophy being expressed in the early chapters. And what Solomon is doing is giving us some guidance. How do we reach these people that are shutting God out of their lives? How do we reach the existentialists? And so you see a rather subtle approach. I mean, people say, you know, when you read Ecclesiastes, you really don't get the purpose of it until you get to the last paragraph of the book. Well, on purpose, Solomon is doing this. He's training us how to reach out to a really resistant people group with respect to the gospel. And you need to be subtle. I mean, some of you who are literature majors may remember that there was a several-year-long debate between C.S. Lewis and the Tolkien. And the debate was, okay, we're trying to spread the gospel through literature. You can use a direct approach or a subtle approach. And you can guess that C.S. Lewis, he had these object lessons, but it was fairly direct, the moral messages he was trying to get across. With Tolkien, he was much more subtle. In fact, people even wondered, was Tolkien really a believer? But Tolkien had many of these debates with C.S. Lewis where he said, I'm trying to reach a different audience. And if you're too direct, they won't pay attention to you. You have to be more subtle, get them thinking. And that's kind of what Solomon is doing here in this book. But what we've been noticing, we've been through the first six chapters, we're in the latter part of chapter seven, looking at the rest of the chapters. And the point is, you see a shift from the first six chapters to the last six chapters. The first six chapters, hardly a hint of God, and you don't see the word fool. As you go into chapter seven, you notice that the word fool is repeated many times, and now God becomes directly mentioned. And so, what you notice is very few proverbs in the first six chapters, and it's like there's nothing but proverbs in chapters 7 through to 12. But as we've been talking about here in the class, notice that the proverbs in the book of Ecclesiastes have a different focus than the proverbs in the book of Proverbs. And so I kind of want you to pick up what that focus is, and how Solomon skillfully brings up the topic of the fool and God. And clearly there's a connection there. And so that's kind of what I wanted you to do. The assignment I gave several of you was to go through not just the book of Ecclesiastes, but the entire Bible and see what it says about the fool and how the fool responds to God. And keep in mind there's several different Hebrew words for fool. And so there's different kinds of fools. So we're going to be looking at different kinds of fools. Hey, you got an extra week to report, so I'm going to actually shut up here and have some of you come forward. And we're going to get this microphone back here, see if we can get that on. And I think that we had four different groups of you assigned to do this study. And hey, if you want to do it on your own and don't want to come up here, it's easy. You get a concordance, get an exhaustive concordance, they're really cheap these days. In fact, you don't even have to buy one. You can go online and look at a concordance for free. And you just look up the word fool, and you can go through the entire Bible and see all the passages and kind of collect them. But the assignment I gave you was to find those passages and then kind of categorize them to see what the different kinds of fools are. So who would like to go first in reporting on their assignment? All right, go for it. Come up here.
I'll be in my big mouth. I always raise my hand. There I am. But anyway, my understanding of the assignment was to go through Ecclesiastes and study all the passages that talk about fool. That was my understanding of it, not to necessarily group the passages together. So
okay, that's where I wanted you to start. Yeah, so let's do that.
Okay.
Because you got about a dozen places where you see the word fool in Ecclesiastes.
Okay, well, I counted 23 verses in Ecclesiastes because I included the word foolish, and I used the King James Version.
Okay,
so the first verse I found was Ecclesiastes 2:14. I don't know if you want to look it up. I have three different versions here, three different translations. Ecclesiastes 2:14. King James Version, the wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness. And I myself perceive also that one event happeneth to them all. Now, New American Standard, which is a little bit more in the modern English, translates the same verse this way, Ecclesiastes 2:14. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I know that one fate befalls them both. Now, Dr. Hugh, I know you like the New International Version. I tend to like the New American Standard, and I won't go into the reasons. But I did find a paraphrase, the New Living Translation. I don't know how you feel about that.
Oh, hey, I like all the translations.
All of them are interesting, I think, yeah. There's a Reader's Digest paraphrase. I don't particularly like that one. But anyway, this is very interesting here, the New Living Translation. For the wise can see where they are going, but the fools walk in the dark. Yet I saw that the wise and the foolish share the same fate. Now, according to a commentary I read, Jameson Fawcett Brown, it says, the worldly wise man has good sense in managing his affairs, skill and taste in building and planning, and keeps within safe and respectable bounds in pleasure, while the fool is wanting in these respects. Darkness, equivalent to fatal error, blind infatuation. Yet one event, death happens to both. So I think that's probably the key part of that verse, that regardless of whether we're fool or wise, we all are going to die.
Right.
And so that goes consistent with your statement that it's a very existential viewpoint in the first, well, in the entire book until the end, basically. And so that's what I have to contribute. I don't know if you want me to talk about any other verses. I can sit down.
Yeah, why don't you sit down and get someone else to come up? That'd be great. Okay. And one thing I want you to kind of really pay attention to, you'll find that the Bible talking about the fool, you'll actually see it repeating the exact same statement. And you know, where you see repetition in the Bible, you need to pay attention. So if you can kind of share with us, you know, where do you find that? Now, I saw another hand go up. You wanted to report? Okay, go for it. Good morning.
Happy New Year, in case I didn't get a chance to tell anyone before. Thank you.
For you.
I found, under King James Version, I found 62 places throughout the Bible, from 1 Samuel to 2 Corinthians. So 1 Samuel 26:21, and then the last one I found was in 2 Corinthians 12:11. Excuse me. I don't know. I didn't pick one that I really, you know, wanted to talk about. So I'll just read off a couple of them and then put the characteristic that I did on the back. Let's see. Okay, we'll take it from Ecclesiastics, since that's basically what we were studying. In Ecclesiastics, say 4:5. Excuse me. Thank you, Steve. Ecclesiastes. Let's see. 4:5 says, the fool foldeth his hands together and eateth his own flesh. So my characteristic for that was doesn't put too much effort into gaining, so does not gain much. and this is just I got the verses from listing them, mm-hmm. you know, going to fool and listing them like you had suggested. In my online, and so that was one, and I just did my own characteristic or explanation
sure.
of the characteristic.
Yes,
so another one will be let me see, I have to check because all of them I did not. Okay. I couldn't think of a characteristic for all of the verses, so that's why I'm checking to make sure I have the characteristic for it. Or maybe I can ask you, and then you could give me one. Okay. Jeremiah 17:11. Let's see. Okay. As the partridge sitteth on eggs, and hatcheth them not, so he that getteth riches, and not by right, shall leave them in the midst of his days, and at his end shall be a fool. So my characteristic for that was putting trust in riches, not trusting in God. Actually, that was something that we talked about in service today. I go to New Song Los Angeles and under Pastor Adam, and he talked about having wisdom, but the wisdom not coming from man, but coming from God. And that's something that's really important that we should remember to do, that when things happen to us, that we have to remember that we have to depend on God and go to God first. Because a lot of times people do things, when things happen to them, instead of going to God first, they try to figure it out and, you know, get it all worked up or worked out within themselves or through man. And the better thing to do is to do it through Christ. Okay. I have more, but.
Well, thank you. Well, it sounds like what you've done, though, is actually collected all the verses. And you know, that might be good to share with the rest of the class.
Okay,
so,
well,
yeah.
I'll type it out because, see, I have it written.
Right.
And I would write it out. So
I'll I thought you had typed some of that. I saw some of the
type. The verses.
Right. Yeah, just the verses. Yeah.
Yeah, I typed the verses out. Actually, I copied and pasted it.
No, that'd be terrific.
And then I wrote on the other side.
Okay. I think that'd be a good collection for all of us, just to have a little written thing with. Has all the verses on the fool. Or I think what would be pertinent for this class too is actually something we could all do is go through the book of Ecclesiastes and actually write out all the places where it talks about the fool. And okay.
I could print mine out too.
Yeah, that'd be great. And I think we had two other groups assigned. You come up. Yeah. I didn't write down the names of the people, but I do remember there were four different volunteers, so this is number three.
What's your name? I forget. Actually, I'm number three and four, because I am John Davis's proxy up here, because John is sick.
That's it. It was John.
So I'm going to steal all his material. Okay, so I'm going to do John's first. He broke it down to... He says there's 182 references in the Bible, 138 in the Old Testament, 44 in the New. And, excuse me, he's got it broken down. So some of the different definitions of a fool: opposite or lack of wisdom or understanding, 68 examples. Things like foolishness of the world, opposite of prudence or discernment, hating or lacking knowledge, unwise counsel. Use of the term by itself without further clarification, 27 examples. In relation to negative behavior, like wrongful anger, doesn't heed correction, impatience, their mouths are their undoing. That never happens to me. 24. And in relation to personality or spiritual characteristics, 14. Things like not honorable or complacency or resentment. So that's... That's John's. All right. Okay. Yes. I think so, but yeah. It seems like his number is kind of low, because he's got 72 in Proverbs. And I found a book that I just happened to be reading a book that talks about fools. How cool is that? And he says there's over 100 references to fool just in Proverbs. And he says there is five Hebrew words for fool. The first one is a simple fool, P-E-T-I, petty. Found in Proverbs 1:4, denotes an ignorant or immature person, but someone who is still teachable. A kessel, K-E-S-I-L, is a petty, ignorant person who is a bit hardened, is stubbornly set in his ways. For example, as a dog returns to his vomit, so a kessel repeats his folly, Proverbs 26. The ewil, E-W-I-L, is similar to the kessel. He adds insolence and anger to his unwillingness to change and will probably respond with quarreling and wrath if you try to correct him. Then the mocking fool, or letz, L-E-T-Z, Proverbs 21:24, the proud and arrogant man, mocker is his name. He behaves with overweening pride. And then the Nabal, N-A-B-A-L, denies that God has an influence in his life. For example, the fool says in his heart, there is no God, Psalm 14. So, you know, the lesson from this is we have to be really discerning in how we deal with the five different kinds of fools. Those are actually five different Hebrew words that are all translated fool in our English Bibles. So, you know, a teachable fool, you can teach. Someone who is completely turned away from the Lord, you may not be able to have an influence on him. Yeah, Doug?
What's the name of that book again?
This is called Restoring the Early Church. Dogowicz, D-O-W-G-I-E-W-I-C-Z. You got that? Dogowicz, D-O-W-G-I-E-W-I-C-Z. It's a good book. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Hugh.
Very good.
Yeah, I was hoping someone would catch that. There actually are five distinct Hebrew words for fool. And I love the way you presented it, Ross, in the sense that you see a gradation. As you go through the different words, they become more and more set in their foolishness. But I think you also concern what is really at the heart of it all. To some degree, they're ignoring God in their life. So, but the simple fool, you know, they're just kind of apathetic. But then you get the hardened fool who insists that there is no God. So, it's, you know, some fools, I don't think there is a God. I know there is no God, and I'm absolutely certain there is no God. So you can kind of see the gradation. But also means you need to use different approaches in reaching out to those different kinds of fools. And that's kind of what Ecclesiastes is all about, is actually helping you discern what kind of fool you're dealing with. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you think it's important to point out that we all can act foolishly occasionally?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's something you're actually going to see in chapter 8 of Ecclesiastes, is to some degree we're all foolish. And the reason for these different Hebrew words is to say, okay, I need to figure out where I'm being foolish, what kind of fool I am, and how I can recover from that. But yeah, saying don't kid yourself, to some degree we're all foolish.
Yeah, there's even a song called What Kind of Fool Am I?
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Pardon
me?
Atheist?
Well, again, according to these five definitions, there are different kinds of atheists. And so when somebody says, I'm an atheist, yeah, it's good to ask them, well, what kind of atheist are you? Okay. And also something, I've been dealing a lot with parents lately because, you know, there's kind of a phenomenon that's taking place in our nation, especially with the young men. They go from, say, their late teens to their early 20s. They've been raised in a Christian home, and they come home and talk to mom and dad and say, I don't believe anymore. I'm an atheist. Almost always what you're dealing with is a young man who's crying out for help, basically saying, if I don't get answers, then I think I'm going to have to go down this path. And they announce themselves as atheists to their parents to get their attention. Now, what's crucial for parents in that situation, don't panic. Okay, oh, my son's become an atheist. I mean, I'm a horrible parent. Rather see it as a call for help. And I think a lot of the blame are churches today who really don't encourage people expressing doubt and skepticism asking challenging questions, giving an environment. In fact, you know, there's surveys been done on young people who leave the church, both men and women. Their number one reason for why they've left the church, no opportunity to ask questions. Yeah. Church is a place we should be able to do that. Okay, go ahead.
Very interesting comment there. When it, where you defined them kinds of fools, then you also said, tells us how to address them.
Yes.
So that's the part I'm interested in.
Yes.
You know, I mean,
well, that's why we're studying Ecclesiastes.
The fool I am, is that solution in Ecclesiastes also?
Well, some of it's in Ecclesiastes. You'll notice that Psalms and Proverbs give you a lot of instruction what to do when you run into a fool. First of all, you've got to find out what kind of fool they are. But what you'll notice in Psalms and Proverbs, they'll say, don't do this with this kind of fool. Do this instead. And so, yeah, I mean, really we want to go beyond just the book of Ecclesiastes. But Ecclesiastes has got unique material in it that you're not going to find, say, in Psalms or Proverbs or Jeremiah or Ezekiel. Those are the places you can go. And what's interesting is that when you go into some of the prophetic books like Jeremiah and Ezekiel, they're targeting different kinds of fools. The book of Ezekiel, for example, is targeting the most resistant of fools. And so you see Ezekiel responding in a very different way than Jeremiah responds. Although Jeremiah is dealing with a class of fool that's just one step below what Ezekiel is having to face. And so, again, we were talking about the debate. How direct can you be? How subtle must you be? When you look at the book of Ezekiel, you'll notice there's many chapters of Ezekiel where God shuts the mouth of Ezekiel. He says, you're dealing with a nation that is too proud and too resistant to respond to your words. What you're going to have to do instead is pantomime. And so what you see is Ezekiel constructing a model of the city of Jerusalem. And then he kicks it all to pieces. And it's basically arousing the curiosity of the bystanders. Why did he do that? But, you know, and then when they begin to respond is when God gives Ezekiel his voice back. And now he can speak. Because now the foolishness he's dealing with has been lowered enough where they can actually respond to the words that he's saying. So, but that's a lesson for us. That, you know, when you're dealing with an extremely resistant fool. And again, if you look at these five words, they're responding to God in different ways. And so like the simple fool is basically someone who really hasn't given it the proper time and attention. And so you can talk to that person. You can talk to them directly. Yeah, comment.
We've talked a little bit before about Ray Comfort. You know, I mean, he's not a scientist, and sometimes he gets over his head in talking to people about science. But one thing I liked about him is one time in a park in New York City, he had a guy fake like he was dead, and they put a blanket over the guy, and they had all these pallbearers all around him, and he drew a huge crowd. In fact, the police even came, because a lot of people thought that was really a dead body. And I thought that was kind of similar to what you were talking about with Ezekiel making a model of Jerusalem and kicking it. You know, it's just like some of these people in New York, I guess, you know, they're kind of like that. You know, they're just proud and they don't want to listen to things of God. But if you get dramatic or have an illustration like that, just out of curiosity, they'll listen, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, I'd be careful what you do in New York. Or was it downtown Chicago somebody was talking about? So, okay. Something else I wanted to get from you about this study we're doing on the fool. Where in the Bible do you see it repeating itself about the fool? It's a couple of places where you actually get the identical words repeated. It's like, even in the same book. Yeah. Right. Yep. That gets repeated. And Ross gave us one. It's in Psalms 14:1. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. Okay, and then you move to Psalm 54 and you get the same verse at the very beginning of the psalm. So the fact that it starts the psalm
with that identical sentence twice. So basically saying, okay, we need to pay attention to that. And basically saying is, that's really the core problem with a fool. They're actually thinking, maybe there's no God. And incidentally, some of the most intelligent people on the earth and the educated people on the earth will say things like that. It's like, gee, how can they? But that happens, and the reason why it happens. And Ecclesiastes 8 gets into the core reason, is that, you know, we're foolish. Yes, go ahead. Right.
So, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do know what you're saying. And, you know, I engage a lot of professional apologists in my role as president of Reasons to Believe. But I think we need to field test our apologetics on fools. And, you know, that can be a problem when we're teaching youth, in the sense we're giving them apologetics, but it's apologetics that in many cases just doesn't work. In fact, a lot of apologetics actually causes more offense than it, so you'd be better off saying nothing. However, what that means is we need to be engaging the fools. And the simple ones and the ones that are one step above that will actually give you critique. If you've got a bad apologetic argument, they'll tell you. So, and I've personally benefited from that. Going on university campuses, giving my evidences for God, and then they tell me what's wrong with my evidences. What does that mean? I get to produce better ones and keep field testing it. But again, you're making a good point. We're not preparing our youth for apologetics. And it needs to be apologetics that actually can help people get past their foolishness. Yes?
Well, there's a kid in our church who goes across the street, and when you spoke in church, he was so excited about it. I think he's 12. And he said, I need to hear the second sermon too. And he brought his parents. And then they came when you weren't here and sat in the chairs and said, we would like to have the kids over there come over and listen to Hugh Ross sometimes. Do you think that would be possible?
Oh, yeah. This is an intergenerational class. And I'll tell you something. Years ago, they were, you know, this is Pasadena area. You get a lot of really precocious children. And they'll be in the kids' Sunday school class, and they're bored and they misbehave. So what I told the teachers, look, if you've got some child that's misbehaving, send them over here. So, because often they're misbehaving because they're just bored with the content.
Maybe once a month or something?
Sure. Well, something else that this class has been doing that I think we need to revisit, and I know you two, Ross and Mark, were involved in this, where we would go once a month to the kids' class and just answer their questions. I don't think we're still doing that, so maybe we need to get that going again. And frankly, what I've seen in other churches is that they'll have our Reasons to Believe volunteers go into the kids' church literally every week just for 5 minutes to answer their questions, but once a month they take the whole class. And that way the kids can really get into a dialogue. And the thing is, get them dialoguing. You know, don't just make it a Q&A, but a Q&A where there's follow-up where they can talk back and engage you. And you know, we need to be doing that with a high school group, but wouldn't it be great if we could start it with the kids and get them into the habit that it's a good thing to ask questions? Because that's, again, the complaint that you see in these surveys of young people who've left the church, who grew up in the church, is that they're taught when they're 6 and 7 years old, you go to Sunday school, you listen and you keep your mouth shut. And then you go on to junior high and it's the same thing, high school, etc. What we need to do is actually inculcate, even at the youngest ages, this is something you want to talk about. And Sunday is a time when you get to ask the big questions. That's why we have a Sabbath. You know, take some time out of your busy life to focus on the most important issues of life. And that's really the problem of the fool. The fool doesn't celebrate the Sabbath. They don't take time out of their schedule to think and talk about the most important issues of life, like the fact, I'm going to die. I mean, isn't that the way a lot of people here in America live? They live their lives as if they're never going to die. It's going to happen. And you need to be thinking about that. You need to be thinking about that on a regular basis. And I started thinking about that seriously when I was 15. Okay, I'm going to die. And there's all this stuff I want to do, but I'm going to die, and I might die in an accident. So I had several close scrapes in my life. And that's the whole point. You could die at any time. And, you know, are you prepared? And, you know, we live in an incredibly complex world here. Did this just happen by chance, or is there a God that made it this way? If he made it this way, why did he make it this way? And that's what I'm finding with youth. They don't just want evidence that God exists. They want to talk about why God did it the way he did. And so that's something we're really trying to focus on at Reasons to Believe, is produce books and DVDs that really stimulate that kind of discussion. And often what's good is you raise the issues and then get them talking about it. That's why we're producing these DVD series. You know, you show them 15 minutes of content, stop, and let's have discussion on this. And let them find out for themselves, discover the answers. Use kind of the Socratic method. Okay, there's a hand, yes.
Yeah, on answering why God did certain things sometimes is very difficult, you know, because we have to speculate sometimes, but if we base that on evidence, maybe they'll accept it. But another thing I want to say, a lot of people say, Sunday's my day. I've heard that so much, you know, and it just, to me, sounds so foolish to just ignore God. And then finally, I wanted to say that my wife and I visited this Filipino church, and this lady was just quoting you all the time. She gave you credit, too. Her whole sermon was based on your apologetics. So, I mean, you do have an influence on a lot of people, you know. I mean, you already know that probably. So.
Well, I didn't know that, so thank you. All right. I saw a hand over here somewhere. No? Okay. Okay. Yeah, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. So how do we get people thinking about God? And that's kind of what the Ecclesiastes is all about, giving us counsel how to get people to think about. And what you notice here in the book is that, in fact, what's good is to kind of go through Ecclesiastes 7 through 12, underline every time you see the word fool, underline every time you see the word God. And what you're noticing is that Solomon, in a very skillful way, is trying to expose the fool to the fact, you know, there really is a God out there. I need to think about him. What does he want with me? What does he want with the whole world? What is my role? What's going to happen after I die? And, you know, it tells us, throw it Ecclesiastes, we as human beings know that death is coming, but we also know death is not the end. And so if you actually take the time, you recognize, whatever your perspective, death isn't the end. And don't you see that in funerals? I mean, even when you attend a funeral where nobody believes in God, they still think that there's some kind of heaven they're going to go to. It's like there's something within us that tells us that death is not the end. Well, if death is not the end, you really should be thinking about what's on the other side. To spend your whole life here on earth, 70, 80, 90 years, and never think what's going to happen after this life is over, that is the ultimate foolishness. I mean, we know that that's going to happen. And you see that in John 16. Every human being knows there's life after death. And every human being knows there's a judgment that's coming. That's why we humans respond to death so differently than the animals. You know, the animals go to the grave with no thought of judgment. Why? Because there is no judgment for the animals. Whereas when we go to the grave, and that's what you notice, is that, you know, people who don't have their life right with God, when they face the time of death, there's a terror that comes over them. And I've shared this with you before. is that, you know, Richard Anderson, who served here for more than 40 years, what he really enjoyed most in his ministry here at Sierra Madre Congregational Church was spending time with people who were on death's door. And he told me personally that he had been with over 300 people that were lucid at the point of their death. And he says, you know, about two-thirds of them were believers. But he says, without exception, if they were lucid at the time of death, they would say to him, I have to say goodbye. He's calling me. He's calling me by name. I must go. And you see that in Psalm 23. Yea, though I go through the valley of the shadow of death, you don't go alone. You get a personal escort. So as a believer, you do not die alone. Jesus Christ will call you by name. In fact, I remember when my dad was dying, he said, son, tell me, what's it like when I'm going to die? And I said, well, you're going to experience your bodily organs shutting down. That's a clue. He said, you're going to start feeling really confused. And that's a clue that the end is really near. But he says, what's going to happen is your body's going to give up trying to sustain life. And you'll have a few hours where you think you're getting better. You feel really great. Because basically, you know, it kind of happens when people are dying of hypothermia. The body stops trying to keep the heat in the body. And when someone's dying of hypothermia, they feel hot. And they start taking their clothes off because of how warm they feel. The body's basically given up trying to trap the heat inside. So the heat just rushes out. And they think they're getting better. They're just minutes away from death's door. So that's what I told my dad, is that there will come a time when you think, hey, things are getting better. Then you know it's probably no more than 24 or 48 hours. But when it comes right to the last few minutes, you will hear your name being called, and he'll take you across the threshold. And it's going to be a glorious experience as you graduate and move on into the next life. Well, I got all that from Richard Anderson. I've had a few experiences with people at death's door myself, and I can tell you what I've seen from Dick Anderson is consistent. Well, let me tell you the flip side. He said, I've also been with people who've been in death's door that have been in the fifth stage of foolishness, where they're adamant there is no God, they hate God, they want nothing to do with God. He says, at death's door, they begin to scream and yell. And they begin to be excited about the fact that they're heading for hell. They want to go to hell. He says, this idea that nobody wants to go to hell, he says, that's not what I see. They're excited and thrilled about the fact that they're heading for hell, and as they head for hell, they scream and curse at the person of Jesus Christ and begin to accuse Jesus Christ of all kinds of vile behavior as they head for death's door. And he said, based on my experiences, I'm persuaded no human being dies sitting on the fence. And that's something you see in Paul's writings in the New Testament. He says, as we live this life here on earth, there are two options. You become a captive of Christ or a captive of Satan. But nobody dies not being a captive. You get to choose who will be captive over your life. But nobody dies on the fence. You know, and some of us live a long time. Some of us don't live a long time. God keeps you alive long enough until you become a captive of Satan or a captive of Christ. In fact, I've written a book over there, it's called Beyond the Cosmos, where I speculate how this works, drawing again from Paul's epistles, how it is in the course of the few decades we have here on earth, we move either into being a captive of Satan or a captive of Christ. And what you'll see in that book is that, based on Paul's writings, Paul makes the point that when we make decisions in our life, and this again is relevant to what we're studying here about the fool. When we make decisions in life, there are three components in our decision-making process. There's your will that you got complete control over. There's the will of Christ in your life and the will of Satan. But what Paul explains in his epistles, when you make a decision to go against the will of God in your life, where you rebel against his will, that has two effects. It doesn't affect your will, But what it does is it weakens the will of Christ in your life and strengthens the will of Satan in your life. But likewise, when you make a decision to side with the Lord, to do the Lord's will in your life, that is the impact of strengthening the will of Christ in your life and weakening the will of Satan. And as I show you in diagrams in the book, if you practice this consistently through your life, consistently choosing to do the Lord's will in your life, then the will of Christ in your life grows stronger and stronger and stronger, and the will of Satan grows weaker and weaker and weaker, and it reaches a point where you become secure in your eternal relationship with Christ. What does that mean? It means that you, by your own free will, have decided to make the Christ component in your life so strong and the Satan component so weak that there is no possibility that your will combined with Satan's will overcome the will of Christ in your life. And you become a captive to Christ's will. So when we enter into the new creation, there is no risk that you're ever going to use your will to become a fool, a rebel against God, because you become a captive of Christ. But there's a flip side to that, where through consistent rebellion against the will of God in your life, you become a captive of Satan, where Satan's will becomes so strong in your life and Christ's will so weak, you can't overcome through any expression of your will the control that Satan has over your life. You become a captive of Satan. And therefore, that's the basis for the unique Christian doctrine of eternal security. You know, the pastor we heard this morning, he's one who's an expert in the different world's religions, and how he talked this morning about how there's things that you only find in the Bible that you don't find in the holy books, the other religions of the world. Well, one of those unique things is that we can be eternally secure in a relationship with the Creator of the universe. No other religion teaches that. Only Christianity teaches that. But also unique to Christianity is that you can become a blasphemer against the Holy Spirit. Technical term in the Bible referring to someone who's totally captive to the will of Satan in their life and therefore cannot possibly be redeemed. And that's something you see as we study the fool. There reaches a point of foolishness where that fool is no longer capable of responding to the gospel. And you actually see instructions in the Bible which says, if you encounter such a person, don't share your Christian faith with them. It will simply drive that person to greater rebellion against God. Moreover, you yourself will experience harm in doing that. So, you know, Jesus said, don't throw your pearls before swine. Again, referring to these individuals who are actually sharing your Christian faith with them, actually do harm to you and will do more harm to them. However, let me add this one caution. It's so easy to run across somebody and say, they're in that category. I'm going to have nothing to do with them. Well, you know, when I was single in this church, I don't know why the church did this. They had me involved in marriage counseling. Particularly ironic, given that I'm on the autistic spectrum, that they had me do that. But I can tell you that experience, I'd be talking to this couple, and you know, what I would do is I'd talk to them together, then I would have them separate and talk to them individually. But I would run into, say, the conversation with the wife, and she would say, you know, my husband has blasphemed the Holy Spirit. I have to divorce him. He's crossed the line. And I says, okay, let me talk to your husband. And I talk to the husband, and there's no way he is in that position. It's like, so it's so easy for us to think that people are much more evil than they really are. And this is one reason why, it was like 30-some-odd years ago, 35 years ago, we did a study in this class. We were over there in the old that park house. We actually looked at every text in the Bible that talks about someone who's blasphemed against the Holy Spirit. And in fact, you can still get this from us. We have it at Reasons to Believe. 57 biblical characteristics of the blasphemer against the Holy Spirit. And the point is this. A real blasphemer has all 57 characteristics. And so I would share that with these couples I was counseling, saying, hey, you've only identified three characteristics, and I got my doubts about the three that you identified. If you can't get the other 54 in the list, then your wife is not in this category. And there's hope for your marriage. Let's see if we can pull your marriage back together. So if you want that, it's still available. So, yes.
My father's going to be 100 in about 2 months.
Wow.
He's pretty senile. So it's really hard to have a good conversation with him, but I take care of him at night. And he said the first night, he said, what about that big river? And I thought he was talking to me. I said, you mean the Sacramento River? Or I thought maybe he'd watch the news or something. He says, no, that's my life. It's been going for hundreds and hundreds of years. And he's an engineer. And he's sort of been resistant. He doesn't think he sins or anything. So then the next night he said, I need you to make the map. He'd been thinking very hard, and I thought, he said, the river is maneuvering.
Hmm.
And I thought, I wonder if it's possible that he's sort of in that gray area. And I don't know how to reach him. I said, well, I mean, I'm not sure, because when he had a plane crash years ago, he got a little tract from somebody who ran up to him and supposedly accepted Christ then. But there's never been much evidence in his life. And I'm just curious, should we just sort of have this surreal conversation about how Jesus is the way across the chasm? And
oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, the very fact that he's talking about the river meandering, I mean, he's thinking about his life, and so, you know, he's thinking about things. He's not in a rigid position.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And just find out what he's talking about, why he's making these comments, and what he needs to know and understand. So
it's pretty, you know, there's not much context there.
Yeah, but when people are close to death, they're more open to talk about these things. And he's not shutting you down. So, again, my own father, when he was told he only had 6 weeks to live, it's like, hey, I got some questions I want to ask. You know, he was much more open about these issues than he had been previously in his life. Because, I mean, he's right there at death's door. So, and if you're 100 years old, you might live another 5 years, but it's going to happen soon. So,
they say you can't teach a dog old dog new tricks, but that's not true.
Well, there's some old dogs you can't teach new tricks, and that's what I'm referring to. But yeah, I mean, that's one reason why the Bible gives us five different kinds of fools. So you've got to treat each one in a different way. And only the fifth category is in a situation, by the way, not all of them are in that category, where you basically say, you know, stay away from them because they're dangerous. You need to give it a shot. And hey, if they start shooting a gun at you, then you can know you need to back off. But yes, well, that's talking about the mocker. And yeah, I've had to debate some atheists who are mockers, and you got to be very careful with what you say and what you do. So, yeah, go ahead, Steve.
A couple of days ago, I ran into one of the verses that I had forgotten that actually changed my life quite a bit. It was about the mocker.
Hmm.
It's a Proverbs 14:6, I believe, or 8. And it was in the Living. I like the Living a lot better. It says, the mocker never finds the wisdom that he claims he is looking for. Yet, it comes easily to the person with common sense. Now, this didn't make sense to me, and so I thought, what is a person with common sense? Well, they're being common with other people, and the mocker's not being common with other people. He's putting them down. And the person who is common is seeing things in other people that they can take and see in themselves and mature. The mocker never matures because he doesn't do that. And just to take that a step further, here we have Jesus Christ who's come and came down and became humble and common with us, that we can see him and mature in Christ. So, and it's powerful to be common because most people are common.
Right. But I think you're raising something. Let me try to pull your two comments together. The one you got to watch out for is the one who thinks he's smarter than everybody else on planet Earth.
Right.
Yeah. they're going to be the most challenging people to deal with.
Which is a natural human tendency anyway.
It's a natural human tendency anyway. But notice Solomon keeps making, you know, he was very smart, but he said, I was foolish. And you know what you notice in the book of Ecclesiastes, he makes the point, every one of us struggles with foolishness to one degree or another. The real fool is a person who won't admit that. That's the one you've got to watch out for. Where they have no idea that they're ever behaving in a foolish way. Or, you know, it really isn't realistic to think I'm the smartest person in the world. So, there's always someone smarter than you. And literally in every topic, yes.
Jewish to Jesus, you know, because I talked to him in the neighborhood. So anyway, he walked with me this week, and I said to him, well, I said, what's your, you know, philosophy of life? What's your worldview? And he goes, well, what's that? Most people don't even think of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know, where do you think, you know, your worldview is, you know, where'd you come from? You know, what's your purpose here? Where are you going to end up? So he says, well, you know, I said, so, he goes, okay, he says, so, I said, well, where'd you come from? Let's start there. He said, the earth. I said, well, that's true. I said, where'd that come from? And he says, well, I guess I came from an ape. And I said, well, you know, I give him the old, your uncle might be a monkey, but mine's not, you know. Every other word is F, and he's fence, and he hates this one and that one. And he never sinned. I said, you ever sin? And he says, well, I never killed anyone. No, I'm not a sinner. And I said, well, I said, do you ever think about where you're going? You know, and he says, well, I don't know. I'm just floating through here. I'm, you know, I have to do whatever I have to do. I got to keep my body strong, and I got to get through. 79 looks great. And, you know, he's got to do this. So then I said to him, I said, but, you know, where are you going to end up? So he finally says, well, I'm not going to worry about that now. I'm going to worry about, you know, me. I have, you know, when I have to meet my maker, that was the secret word. He says, I'll give an account then. I says, aha, we got someplace. You've admitted, finally you have a maker. You know? And then he goes, I got to go now. I'll see
That is funny, but you know, notice that people always ask, you know, how do you get conversations started with people, get them on a spiritual path? She asked a great question. What is your philosophy of life? The vast majority of adults here in America have never thought about a philosophy of life. And it's like, and you know, if you can get them to admit that they haven't done that, then you've got somewhere where you can start. Yeah. Right. I know you will. But yeah, you know, what is your philosophy of life? And they say, well, I haven't really thought about that. You know, don't you think that's important? So, and you're basically encouraging to, yes.
Samuel Johnson said, knowing one is to be hanged in a fortnight clarifies the mind wonderfully.
Yes. Well, it does. In fact, I was just sharing with people as we were waiting for Ross to finish up his sermon in the previous class. By the way, they really liked what you had to say. So, well, we were out there, and my mind just went blank. What were you just saying? Yeah, I was just sharing with them how, like, about 25 years ago, I got a letter from someone in Texas, and he was in prison, and he was on death row. And, we were giving our books to prisons that were damaged. He got one of those books, and it brought him to faith in Christ. So he says, I've become a Christian through your book, and I'm starting a Bible study with other prisoners here in death row. And what he told me was, literally just in 3 months, he led everyone on death row to Christ. It's kind of like what you say. If you know that death is just around the corner, where you actually have a date in the calendar, this is when you're going to get executed, suddenly your philosophy of life becomes quite important. And the real problem with a lot of people, like this guy, what is he, 79? He's living his life, it's like he's got another 50 years. So. I'm working out, I'm going to live forever, and, no one I know of has ever lived forever, so you need to think about that. Death is coming, and, I tell people who are in that position, I look at life like a roll of toilet paper, okay? In this sense, when you're young, it takes, it doesn't go down very fast. When you get to the very end, it's just like it disappears really quickly. Life goes by fast when you're up in years, and it's going to be over before you know it. I mean, if you're 79, it's going to feel like a whisper of time before you're at death's door. Maybe you need to start thinking about it right now. So,
coming to an end.
Coming to an end.
One more questions or comments? I'd like you just to get a little wrap up and pray, please.
Okay. Well, again, what I want to encourage you to do is look at chapter 7 through chapter 12. We'll actually do this next week. We're going to look at every passage where you see the word fool or foolishness. And then we're going to try to figure, okay, what is the point that Solomon's getting across in terms of these fools and how we can reach them and turn them away from their foolishness? And here's a hint. You might also want to look up all the places where you see the word God, because that's kind of what Solomon's doing, is linking the foolishness with the fact that people aren't paying enough attention to God. The fool lives their life as if there is no God, or they believe in God, but they don't pay attention to God. That's kind of what you're going to see as you go through these texts. So at least if, say, some of you could do that between now and next week, then we'll dive into that. And, yeah, I'm going to be with you. I don't think I have to go out of town for another 6 weeks. So, all right. Let's bow for prayer. And this is thanks to the encouragement of my wife. She says, Hugh, it's going to rain really hard this afternoon. Make sure you end your class on time so that people can get to their cars before they get totally soaked. So it's already raining pretty heavy. So anyway, Father in heaven, thank you for this time. Thank you, Lord, for raising up this amazing man, King Solomon. Lord, the experiences you gave to him, the life lessons, the hard knocks that he experienced. Lord, but we're grateful as we read this book to see how he bounced back from his own foolishness and became wise in your eyes. And Father, I pray as we go through this that you'd help us to identify where foolishness resides in our heart. And Lord, give us a capacity to see a foolishness in the hearts of people that we meet. And give us the skills, Lord, to guide them, just like you guided King Solomon. Back to a wise and gracious heart. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you. Thank
you. I was one of the ones in the group.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, but I could do this part next week. Okay. Beginning.